Once again, I wanted to talk about the term real and unreal and does not exist. And I asked yesterday, what did Robert and Ramana mean when they said you do not exist and the world is not real? Does it mean nothing exists? Does it mean things exist but are impermanent? This is the Buddhist view. Robert explained that everything in the world, including our bodies and minds, were appearances only. They had no solid and real existence apart from our minds. On top of that, our minds are not real. They're just a collection of thoughts without a thinker. That is, there's consciousness upon which our minds create names and forms, objects, and the internal and external worlds. We discover that the world is unreal when we discover through self-inquiry that we are unreal. Since we are unreal, all other people and the entire world is unreal. And it's explained further in the sutras that when one perceives the real self, the world is unreal. But as long as one perceives the world as real, one does not find the self as real. So it's like a gestalt thing. You either see one way or the other way. It's your identification, whether you identify with consciousness or you identify with the subject being located within the body. And when you break out of that and identify with the totality of consciousness, that's close to identifying with the self, and that's what they mean, the spaciousness of consciousness. But I'll try to get into that experience a little more, because this word seems to cause so many problems, because people don't have the experience of the unreality of the world. Therefore, their minds spin and spin and spin and spin, create all kinds of psychological and moral problems about an unreal world and an unreal person, whether you can commit suicide or whether you can commit murder, and whether you should do anything, and why do I teach, and also so forth. So let me try to clarify the term a little bit. Yesterday, before we were broken off, I was talking about taking a shower. I was feeling the water hitting my head and back, and for the 10,000th or 20,000th time, I looked inside myself with my inner eye and saw for the 1,000th time an internal emptiness, the world which interpenetrated all thoughts, all objects, my body, and the world. And this is something you develop over a period of years of meditation. The space inside opens up, and you feel the spaciousness, and you perceive it with your inner eye and your imagination. And all objects are absorbed by it, and all thoughts are in it, and it's you're no longer contracted down inside the body. But for that time, for the first time in 10,000 times of looking within, something different happened. I saw that there was no internal entity, no inner eddy, who was the center or witness or thinker or controller. That is, the word I did not point to anything. All that there was everywhere, was emptiness, and I was that. I was nothing. I was emptiness, not a thing at all. And as such, emptiness is out of this world. It's not touched by fire. It's not touched by age. It's not touched by death. It's beyond life and death. It's beyond the world. I saw that everything in the world and everything in my mind was just a concept. The mind took some impression or other from outside, and I'll use the term in quotes, and formed it into an object within the structure of an apparent human being looking out through apparent eyes onto an apparent external world. Everything was idea. That's what I saw. Everything was idea. Without the mental thinking apparatus, all that existed was consciousness, whose basic nature was presence and emptiness or void. Thoughts created names and forms. My identity with my body totally disappeared. I saw that my body was really a concept, an inner image that brought together my visual experience of my body as seen from my eyes located in my sentient meatball head, and the tactile sensation I had of my body touching against the environment, combined with inner feelings of pain or movement. The mind combined all of these disparate sensations and constructed a composite entity, my body, which only existed in my mind, but not in my inner experience of the body or the world. I didn't have an inner experience of the body and the world. I constructed that out of thought, an image brought together over years of combining disparate kinds of sensations. This is the experience that I try to... Lakshmi's going to jump up on me, and I'm afraid she's going to step on the keyboard. This is what my emptiness-guided meditations are supposed to teach, that experience. There is no body in one's experience without an inner imaginary image to create the body form. Without that image, you experience yourself as emptiness, with spots of existence spread all over space. A tactile sensation here, another tactile sensation there, hearing some words, seeing your toes, and these are all combined together into a sense of you as a body. And then you identify with that for the rest of your life. And therefore you fear when the body dies because you feel you die. The body as a mind-created entity was no longer my identification. Instead, I now identified with everything, but mostly with the emptiness, the void within which everything is only an idea. I was no longer the body, but space itself. The center of my beingness was no longer on the body, but was the space that pervaded everything. When I looked at any apparent object, immediately the thought that created that image came into my awareness also, and I could see how the thought created every specific object. None of those objects were real. They were appearances and nothingness, created by ideas. Moreover, the ideas were not my ideas, but universal ideas shared by everyone. We all lived in the same world of shared objects created by shared ideas. And yet these ideas had enough shaded meaning so that no two people ever is certain they're talking about the same experiences. I'll tell you something else is... when you're in that kind of concentration state, you can actually see thoughts. They have a form. I don't know if some of you have floaters in your eyes because you're nearsighted, where there are little internal clouds that obscure sometimes your vision and they float around. Well, thoughts have an appearance like that when you're in an intense concentration state, and you can find a specific thought, approach that thought, and suddenly when you get close enough, the thought disappears and becomes the object. And it's a very unusual experience. It's not one you want to do all the time. It's just something that you should know about and that you could try to do it when you're in deep concentration. However, I was none of these things. I was not the experience. I was not the thoughts. I was not the words. I was nothing. I did not exist. I was only an idea and had no existence except as an idea. I was not real. But therefore, nothing was real except the totality of consciousness, manifest as space, populated by objects created by thoughts. Later, I was to discover even that the totality of consciousness was not real. Even the all-encompassing, spontaneous existence around us consciousness is not real. And this is what Ramana and Robert meant when they said that the world is not real. It's created by mind. Now, one can experience the direct seeing of reality, in quotes, thingness, without the intermediary of mind through intense meditation on nothingness. At Mount Baldy, I think within 6 weeks of intense meditation effort, everybody was able to totally dissolve their self, the sense of existence, the self, the sense of being a person, and identify with the totality of consciousness, which is a very different experience. It's a kind of samadhi. I don't know what the name of that specific samadhi is for, but it recurs over and over again. You begin to wonder which is the real reality. Well, the real reality is either with thought or without thought, and it's not a simple stopping of the mind. It's got to be much more deep and much more intense than temporarily stopping the thoughts. The mind has to drop down into the body, into the lower part of the body, so that the energy gets out of the head and gets lower and lower. And when that happens, the barrier between you and the world disappears, and you become one with everything in the world. But the things in the world no longer have name and form. And other than that, I can't describe the state. You'll have to experience it. When the mind disappears, one becomes everything, all consciousness, without forms or names, ever flowing and electrically bright. The world becomes very intense. However, even then, later on, we realize that this flowing consciousness itself is not real. It is only a concept and is impermanent. Now for the main theme of this talk, and this is important. Robert began his spiritual journey after witnessing his aunt killing and beheading a chicken. He could not believe anyone could do such a thing and went into a deep depression for a long time, I think a couple of years or more. Then one day an answer came to him as a sudden insight, a mini awakening. And it was a cop-out to be sure, but it laid the foundation for his awakening 3 years later. He came to the conclusion that the world was not real. It could not be real. Otherwise, there was so much horror, it would be impossible to bear. Now, in psychology, we would call this, what would we call that? I forget. He came to the conclusion that the world was not real. It could not be real. Robert's constant message was after that was to leave the world alone and not get involved in it. While we were with him over and over again, he'd say that there have been gurus and reformers since the beginning of history, yet the world really has not changed much or become a better place to live. He used to call the world we live in the lowest of hells. And there's a lot of evidence for that. 65 years ago, World War II had just killed 50 million people worldwide in just 6 years. 2,000 years ago, during the entire 600-year history of the Roman Empire, the Romans may have killed a million people, maybe less. Thus, the human race had progressed during 2,000 years to the place where we could kill people 5,000 times faster than the Romans. Is this progress? Just read the history of the last 50 years and we see endless wars, endless poverty, endless death by disease, and endless efforts at ethnic cleansing where whole ethnic groups try to annihilate other ethnic groups for one reason or another. Then there are the earthquakes and tsunamis. 7 years ago, an earthquake and tsunami killed 250,000 people in a few hours. Every few years, an earthquake kills hundreds and thousands of people in Italy, Armenia, or China. Death is everywhere. Who hasn't been touched by death? Every year in the United States, 10 billion farm animals are slaughtered to feed a few hundred million people. as billions of animals, not millions. These would be chickens, cows, turkeys, pigs, etc. Not to mention the death toll among sea creatures, such as fish and whales. Is this progress? Our seas are gradually being fished out, populations decimated. And socially, in our own country, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and all the social welfare programs are under attack by Republicans who want all wealth to remain in the hands of a few who fight tooth and nail to prevent the rich from paying an additional 5% in income tax. Greed and increasing corruption are overtaking this country, just like it has all over the world, such as in Russia and more recently in India. Consciousness is excessively good at killing things. Everything that moves, lives, or breathes. And before consciousness kills us, it makes us suffer. This was Robert's point of view, and also the review of Ramana, who urged followers to leave the problems of the world's suffering to God to take care of, because it was his creation. There's a recognition in Robert and Ramana that the individual can do little or nothing to ease the suffering in the world. It's a kind of cultural fatalism of the Hindus and, to a lesser extent, the Chinese and other Asian cultures. We must realize that consciousness has no intention to go the way we'd like it to, towards a world of peace, love, integrity, and decreased suffering. In many ways, the world appears to be going backwards towards increasing violence and death. Many New Agers are of the opinion that we are an upward spiral of consciousness, and awakening is happening all over the place, and soon we'll all be living in a golden age. But I find no evidence for such evolution. I see absolutely no general progress towards a golden age. This is my view. The people that attend these satsangs are exquisitely sensitive to suffering. They have felt it in their life, and they have seen it all around them for all of their lives. They want suffering to end, but feel powerless to end the suffering. Then we read the teachings of Robert and Ramana, who say, leave the world alone, attend only to your own inner experience, as the world is unreal, as are you, and the suffering is unreal also. In these words, they find relief. Turning within is a relief from the suffering, because you find that sense of presence inside of you which is blissful and happy. You also find that concepts that people use are ultimately empty and have no meaning. And this is a kind of salvation also, because you become more free from concepts such as the American dream or desire for great wealth or other security, realizing these are just imposed dreams, the fulfillment of which really don't change things much and certainly don't yield much happiness. Instead of finding happiness without, either by acquiring things as part of some dream, we become happier, finding peace, rest, and happiness in our own inner sense of presence. Still, even after we see through all the lies, corruption, and misguided efforts of mankind and want no part of it, we still secretly suffer because of the suffering around us, and we feel helpless to make it end. We don't know how. Robert, despite constantly urging satsang goers to leave the world alone, to withdraw from the world, would always encourage me when I was reaching out to make some change in the world, either rescuing animals or taking on deluded and corrupt politicians in Santa Monica. He would even mention at satsang that it was good that someone was doing something. As Mary Skane, my longtime friend and and Robert's left-hand woman said about me, this to me. She said, Ed, Robert saw in you intelligence and power to actually change things, and he encouraged you to do that. She was right. Robert's general teaching to leave the world alone was directed to those who were overcome with suffering, anger, fear, and feelings of helplessness and hopelessness. He said to turn away from the world and go into yourself, to go deeply into yourself to find peace and happiness, to leave the world alone. Let the power that knows the way take care of the world. That was his message for those overwhelmed by suffering. He gave them a path of peacefulness and relative happiness. But what I took out of Robert's encouragement of my efforts to make positive changes, at the same time telling everyone else to ignore the world and only turn within to escape suffering, is that once you came to a place within yourself where you were no longer overwhelmed by the vastness of the suffering and pain of the world, but acquired some peacefulness for yourself, happiness, and most of all, self-confidence and courage, then you should look around yourself, evaluate yourself and your abilities, and make a decision to do what small things you can to improve your immediate world. I sort of drew a line around myself and established what was within it and what was without it. And within my line, I would do everything possible to improve that world and to reduce suffering in it. And part of that was I saw the suffering of animals and vowed to make a difference in this arena. Not only in the life of the animals that lived with me, but animals throughout the city. That's when I founded a political blog in Los Angeles that explored animal issues within Los Angeles and Santa Monica, and found out what governments were doing about animal sheltering, and advanced an effort to move all shelters towards being no-kill shelters. I also addressed the plight of about 1 million or 2 million homeless cats on the streets of Los Angeles. Even given this limited venue is too large for one person to make much difference, but I try, and I have had some success in making the city a more humane and loving place towards animals. 4 you, after you turn within, inquire into yourself, into the depths of your psyche and inner world. Find some peace, understanding, and most of all, self-confidence and power. Then I urge you to continue to take note of the suffering in the world around you and make a decision in your own small way to relieve that suffering however you can. In his small book, Self-Knowledge and Self-Realization, Nisargadatta states that upon awakening, the sage becomes an embodiment of a sense of justice, of right versus wrong, and he also develops the power to do something about it. Why this is the case, I don't know, and he does not say. This is the way things are. Rajiv, after awakening, is now finding his own mission in the world involving homeless and poor children in India. Many of you already have a well-defined personal mission of somehow improving the world. You have a vision. You have intelligence. You have power. And I urge you to go do it. Carry out that mission. Like I've said many times, not everyone is slated to awaken in this life. And in the grand perspective, including that of your life, there may be things more important than self-awakening. And that is to share your compassion with the world. Make this a better place to live for all sentient beings before they are slaughtered by consciousness. In a sense, I think of us here in this satsang as being shepherds for all sentient beings. We take on the mission of taming consciousness from her current way of being a harsh mistress. You might say we are the vanguard of a movement of conscience and compassion within the tumult of a suffering consciousness. There have always been people who are driven by a sense of compassion and love for all others, and who have strived to help all sentient beings. They have seen their efforts sometimes accomplish very little, yet it is their acts that inspire all of us to do more. I once had a mentor, a woman named Wilma, who loved cats. Wilma was disabled and had emphysema, which is gradually crushing the life out of her. But she was always by her phone answering questions put to her by various rescuers and clients of the veterinarian she worked for about how to take care of cats and dogs. That's all she did. Wilma was one of the most knowledgeable and caring persons I ever knew about cats. She lived alone in a studio apartment with 14 rescued cats, always worried that the landlord would find out how many she had, as she was only allowed 3 by her lease. She would adopt out perhaps a dozen cats a year, maybe more, but she never had less than 12 cats in her apartment. One time, the city of Santa Monica was after me because I was feeding a colony of 13 cats in a very wealthy area of the city and had been doing so for several years. But then we had the great earthquake of 1994, which destroyed many of the homes, and new neighbors moved in and rebuilt those homes. These mansions, these $5 and $6 million houses in Santa Monica. And they objected to me feeding the cats near their property, claiming the cats were pooping on their lawns, etc. One even complained to me that the cats were sleeping on the lawn furniture and made it dirty, offered to clean it, and that got nowhere. The entire city was after me. The city's structure was after me, the bureaucrats, the police force. They sent a detective to harass and lie to me. They had animal control give the neighbors traps to trap the cats, after which they would have been taken to the city's animal shelter and destroyed because they were feral. And I fought them. I arrived at 5 in the morning to feed the cats very generously, and then again at night after the neighbors had gone to sleep. The cats were so well fed, none of them went into the traps and none were ever caught. The neighbors complained to the city that I was feeding them too much food and the cats were not going in the traps. Some of the neighbors even had friends bring dogs and release them near where I fed the cats at night, right in front of me, to have the dogs chase and maybe kill the cats. The detective was even telling neighbors that animal control was going to come in with dart guns to capture the cats and kill them. All this was done to intimidate me into stopping feeding the cats so that the neighbors could trap and have the cats killed. Such was the mentality in Santa Monica, and such the mentality is still in most of the United States. This is when Wilma stepped in. She began organizing a campaign to stop the city from hounding me and the cats. She called her hundreds of friends who were rescuers, each of whom ran a rescue group and each of whom had a mailing list. Each of them called their friends, and altogether they started calling City Hall, the city manager and city attorney, telling them to leave me and the poor cats alone. The first day, the city manager received over 300 phone calls telling them to leave me and the cats alone. Over the next 2 or 3 days, they received another 400 to 500 phone calls telling them to leave me and the cats alone. At that point, the city manager threatened in a very sinister way that I'd better use my time trapping the cats and getting them out of the city as opposed to mobilizing a public effort to get the city to leave the cats alone. They ordered me to get the cats out of town or they would capture and kill them. Well, resistance is not futile. Wilma and I continued to resist. And to make a long story short, because of Wilma's efforts, the city finally gave in and stopped harassing me and the cats. They were overwhelmed by 1,000 phone calls from all over the United States and the world during a one-week period of time, telling them to stop harassing me and the cats. The city attorney even sent me a letter stating that feeding cats was not illegal and they would not be coming after me anymore. And all of this was due to Wilma, a 74-year-old gravely ill woman living alone in a room with 14 cats and a telephone, and who had hundreds of friends who also loved animals. Sadly, Wilma died a few years later, virtually unknown as a saint she was, except to a few hundred rescuers and a few hundred clients of that veterinarian where she worked part-time as a receptionist before emphysema made her totally housebound. Wilma taught me the power of publicity and having lots of friends with a common interest, and in this case, a love for animals, and anger towards a system that favored the wealthy and their desires over the lives of 13 homeless and beautiful sentient beings. In the end, many of those little kitties found homes, several with me, some died in the streets. Such was the suffering I saw and continue to see every day. Even given the vastness of the suffering I continue to see, I still do my small part to help the lives of a few hundred cats every day in every way I can, and help those people who help other cats. One person asked me once, "Ed, why do you put so much importance on animals when you realize that the world is not real?" My answer is, do you stop going to the movies even when you realize they are not real? Your apparent body is going to live another 30 or 40 years or so. So what do? Nothing? You stop eating and allow yourself to starve to death? Or do you participate in that unreal world created by your thoughts? Romana and Robert mostly chose to withdraw. But to withdraw or participate is up to you. You don't have to follow their lead or my lead or anybody's lead. Find your own way. In that same vein, the more you are aware of your inner sense of presence, the happier you become and the more compassionate you become, which frees energy and confidence, which allows you to actually do something in the world. Combine that with the growing sense of justice that Nisargadatta talked about, and many people who are realized feel an obligation to engage in the world. The unreal world exists totally within that sense of presence, and that sense of presence is itself filled with love and is love. It is almost automatic that a person immersed in that sense of presence acts compassionately and with love in all actions. We can all regard ourselves as part of a movement of conscience within consciousness that has always been there. That movement's always been there, and whose focus has been to reduce suffering everywhere. In fact, the ending of suffering was the goal of Buddha's life, and is the single classical goal of Buddhism. One of the four monastic vows says, "Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all." The act of saving is an act of supreme happiness. You are saving your beloved, and in that saving you find more love. You are my spiritual family, and I wish you all very well. I love you all and hope you find some peace and well-being in your life through spiritual practices. Then when you feel ready, look inside your heart, find out who you are, and then look outside to find out how that movement of conscience and compassion within the greater envelope of consciousness as a whole is directing you to serve as a shepherd for all sentient beings. some of you, gratefully, have already defined your mission as working with me. Joanne and Alan in building a satsang family. Others by building websites for Robert's teachings or my teachings. Others transcribe these talks while others still compose music for satsang. Others propose making a movie that would bring Robert's teachings to all people as a transmission of compassion. Others want to help me help cats. Others make donations to the animal work and to satsang. Such is how that movement of conscience and compassion is acting in its own way to tame that harsh mistress of consciousness. May we as a family continue to grow in this togetherness effort to bring more love, light, and compassion to the world. The world consciousness needs us. We are a small movement that in some way is contributing to making the world an easier place to live in for all beings, for all time. May the world remember that there was once this spark of compassion that was lit here by Ramana passing through Robert, through me, and to all of you. One of the most beautiful chants in the world is Jota Se Jota. It goes like this. Kindle my heart's flame with thy flame. Sadguru, kindle my heart's flame with thine. May thy light banish darkness forever. Sadguru, kindle my heart's flame with thine. O Lord of Yoga, Lord of Wisdom, O Lord within all, O Lord above all, kindle my heart's flame with thine.